Today on the LA Food Podcast, I'm your host Luca Servodio, but you can call me Luca Brasi, dear listener, because today we're joined by none other than the godfather of LA's pizza renaissance. Daniele Uditi is the chef and partner behind Pizzana, one of Los Angeles's best and most influential pizzerias. Daniele joins us for a wide-ranging conversation that covers everything from his upbringing living above his aunt's bakery near Naples, Italy, to his spontaneous relocation to LA, which ultimately led him to meeting Candace Nelson and launching a bona fide pizza empire. We talk about the nitty-gritty of dough and sourcing excellent products, but Daniele also offers us a window into the evolution of LA's pizza scene over the last decade, what it means to lead a business with integrity in this day and age, and what he thinks of all of those pizza lists you see doing the rounds on social media. We learn about what his favorite pizzas in Los Angeles are, besides his own, of course, and we also hear about how he ideated the Padrino, LA's best Italian sandwich, which is now permanently available for lunch at Pizzana's Marina del Rey location. But first, a couple of things that caught my eye. David Chang has chili crunched his way into quite the controversy. LA Taco is in dire need of our help, and Coachella is upon us, so I break down the 5 eats you absolutely must make time for if you're headed to the desert this weekend. That's all coming up next, so without further ado, let's chow down. The LA Food Podcast is brought to you by House of Macadamias. Dear listener, do you have a favorite nut? Here's why I've happily given that title over to the macadamia. First, it's chock full of nutritional benefits, including one of the best omega 6 to 3 ratios in the nut game. 8 times better than pistachios and 20 times better than cashews. Cashew? More like cash-ew. Second, it's super versatile. You can have them as a snack. You can find tons of applications to include them in your cooking. You can even use the oil for cooking, in addition to using it for skin and health purposes. If you want to get in on the macadamia game, head to the LA Food Pod page on houseofmacadamias.com to access my curated list of macadamia products. We've got extra virgin cold-pressed macadamia oil, savory macadamia snack packs, and salted or unsalted macadamia nut butter. All great for snacking, all great for cooking. The best part is, when you buy an LA Food Pod bundle on houseofmacadamias.com, you'll instantly get a free multi-pack of macadamia snack bars featuring flavors like chocolate, white chocolate, and coconut white chocolate. And if you subscribe to our bundle, you get a 15% discount on all of it. And don't worry, you can pause, cancel, or adjust the subscription at any time. So what are you waiting for? Head to www.houseofmacadamias.com/pages/LA-foods and go nuts. Dear listener, I feel like the tide is finally turning and spring may be upon us. We've had some absolutely gorgeous days in the City of Angels this past week. Of course, it's supposed to rain tomorrow, but you know, that's just part of living in LA, it seems now. It actually reminds me of growing up in Switzerland. The running joke used to be, if you don't like the weather, just wait 5 minutes. And that very much seems to be the case in Los Angeles these days. Anyways, enough about me. We've got a few things to discuss today before we get to today's big interview with Daniele Uditi of Pizzana. A couple not so fun things and then one super fun thing. Kicking things off, I've got to talk about David Chang's Chili Crunch Gate. Now, in case you missed this somehow, dear listener, news broke last week by The Guardian that David Chang's Momofuku had been attempting to trademark the names Chili Crunch with an E and Chili Crunch with an I, and they'd started to send cease and desist letters to smaller companies using that name on their products. In the piece from The Guardian, Momofuku was branded as a quote-unquote trademark bully, and lots of people got upset about them trying to monopolize what is a very widespread condiment in Chinese and Asian American cuisines more broadly that's been around for hundreds of years. Some people did come to Momofuku's defense, and believe it or not, it wasn't just Father Saul, who we know is David Chang's number one stan. what the people who came to Momofuku's defense were saying is that this isn't really a Momofuku or a David Chang issue. This is really an issue having to do with U.S. trademark law, which basically forces you to enforce your trademark once you've applied for it. Momofuku themselves have also been defending themselves in a piece that Jen Harris wrote for the LA Times on the situation. She included their statement, which basically said that, look, this was never intended to quote unquote stifle innovation in a category that apparently they care deeply about, to quote them. What they were trying to do is that they wanted a name they could own and intentionally pick Chili Crunch as opposed to other types of names, including Chili Crisp, which they believe were sort of more widely spread. They're basically insinuating that if they went for Chili Crisp, that would have been somehow more problematic than Chili Crunch. Of course, the question then becomes, why did you want a name you can own, right? And I think that question has been made to Momofuku. It's also been made to Fly By Jing, who were very, very loud in the wake of the David Chang news in basically criticizing Momofuku. But Jen Harris points out in her piece that they too tried to trademark Sichuan Chili Crisp, only to be told no. They did this years ago, and then interestingly, they actually did this again a few, like in the wake of the news. Since then, the owner of Fly By Jing has said that she regrets filing that request for trademark, and they actually retracted it. But basically, they did it because they're freaking out, right? Like, people are worried now. Okay, Momofuku is owning the name Chili Crunch. They're coming after people. So people basically want to protect their own interests. To the people who are saying, what do you expect? Momofuku is a big business doing the things that big businesses do. I would really urge you to go read Jen Harris's piece in the LA Times, which we will link in the show notes. And I think that really speaks to why this is such a deeply emotional issue that gets at the heart of people's cultural identity. I think my take on this is it's sad, but this is kind of the natural progression of things when a celebrity chef like David Chang gets too big, right? It's like, you know, you've heard of too big to fail. I also believe it's kind of like too big to be a good person sometimes, you know. You can say a lot of bad things about David Chang, and if you've listened to this podcast before, I have said almost all of them. However, there are a few things you can't deny. He has done a lot throughout his career to make Asian foodways firmly entrenched in the mainstream. He's been an advocate for combating stereotypes against MSG, and he's also railed against the idea of ethnic food aisles at the grocery store. He's called them racist. And he's done a lot to really, you know, advance and demolish hurtful stereotypes that have been ailing Asian cuisine and Asian restaurateurs for a really long time. However, I think that you can kind of see this with other restaurateurs too and other celebrity chefs. But as you get bigger, you become a brand and you kind of start to lose yourself. Dave Chang, you know, whether you like him or not, is likely not personally responsible for this, right? He's doing TV. He's hobnobbing, with famous people. He's not overseeing patenting and trademarking. I'm sure he's signing off on it at some degree, but he's not the one sending the small businesses the cease and desist letters. To that point, though, when your name is on the building, you've got to take accountability for everything. And I think as an entity, he's inching dangerously closer to being a Rick Bayless eating the lunch of small entrepreneurs of color, as opposed to being the ally and advocate he has been in the past. My other theory about this is I think David Chang is doing too much. He is absolutely everywhere. He's spread thin. I mean, he's doing TV, right? He's got like 14 shows on the air right now. He's got a podcast. He's got many restaurants. He's got restaurants opening up all over the world. He's got an endless laundry list of products for sale. To me, he's stretched too thin because you can kind of see the quality slipping in almost everything he does, right? I don't think the shows that he's been putting out are that high quality. And I know that he has the ability to put out high quality shows because Ugly Delicious, for example, was a fantastic show. His restaurants, I don't think, are reaching the heights they used to reach, right? Like, Major Domo is a well-loved restaurant in Los Angeles, kind of, but it's certainly not creating the buzz or getting the attention that his earlier restaurants in New York did either. And now with his business, you're kind of seeing the business practices slip up as well. They're doing things that are not considered good business practices that are, you know, I think advancing certain types of food in the country overall, big picture, right? I think the man's spread too thin. I think he's got to do way less. And I think that this is the perfect opportunity for him to perhaps take a breather. That's enough about David Chang for right now. One other thing I wanted to talk about today that's in the not so happy news corner of the universe is some news that LA Taco announced this week that they were unfortunately having to furlough staff due to budget issues. They said they're going to need at least 3,500 new subscribers to avoid layoffs. Apparently, their situation only got worse after they were forced to postpone their LA Taco Madness event that was supposed to happen this weekend, but they canceled it due to rain. I think LA Taco is a really important discussion for us to keep having in terms of like whenever we discuss media in the city of Los Angeles, because there's really nothing else like it out here, right? There's a lot of good local journalism in Los Angeles when it comes to food. You know, we've got the LA Times, we've got Eater, we've got The Infatuation. I think what all of those outlets have in common is that they're owned by bigger fish. Bigger fish who expect financial results. And yes, you can plead editorial independence all you like. At the end of the day, there's a bottom line associated with those newsrooms, right? That cannot be said of LA Taco. Like, LA Taco is not owned by anybody else. They are an independent local journal, like source of journalism. And that is essential. Yes, we can talk about their taco lists, which along with journalists like Bill Esparza, continue to be like where new spots, where the spots of people who are really, really like coming to this country and making food from scratch and bringing new and interesting like cookery from all over the world, but especially Mexico and Central America. LA Taco is really doing the work and like bringing that to the masses and popularizing those spots. That's huge. And that's something that we cannot afford to lose. There's also Taco Madness, right? Which is this is an incredible yearly event they put on. And I've kind of derided it in the past as a popularity contest. And to some degree it is, right? It's just people voting for their favorite taquerias. But I cannot stress the level of sort of like community involvement and togetherness that it inspires. And I know this because, you know, my local taqueria, Villa's Tacos, really, really like goes for it every year and rallies the entire community behind them in a way that few things do. It like the only other time I think Los Angeles comes together, even though it's neighborhood by neighborhood with LA Taco Madness, like the only other time I've seen neighborhoods come together like that is like when the Dodgers win the World Series, right? And that happens like once every 30 years. So we absolutely cannot count on that for unity. So we Taco Madness doing great things to bring the city together. Finally, forget the food. LA Taco does incredible journalism about topics that are underreported in other parts of the media. And we know this as the LA Food Podcast. We've had Jeanette Villafana on our podcast to talk about street vending, right? And street vending is something that they follow incredibly closely, not just because it's food related, but because it's a really important policy issue that has been plaguing our city for literally more than 100 years if you really look at the history of street vending. And LA Taco is doing essential journalism on that. Yes, some folks at the LA Times are also doing good jobs on it, but LA Taco is a leader on it. They're a leader on a number of other issues. And as a city, we are better because LA Taco exists. Look, they need members. If you can, go spend as little as $9.99 to become a member. That is literally less than a foot long at Subway these days, okay? Remember the days of the $5 foot long? Those are long gone. These days, you're spending $12 to $13 for one of those rubbery sandwiches that Nancy Silverton has no problem associating her name with, okay? Don't do that. Instead of that, maybe have some food at home and spend $9.99 on becoming a member of LA Taco. You will not regret it. I want to end on this before we move on to our conversation with Daniel Diti, and this is good news, okay? Coachella is upon us, my friends. Weekend one of Coachella starts today, okay? Friday. It's today. It's happening. People are going to the desert. And if you're one of those people, yes, you might be excited to be listening to music, but you're probably also excited about what you're going to be eating. And that's because I'm going to say something. I think that, yes, Coachella is an incredible music festival, but it has actually become one of our best food festivals too. I mean this. I mean, look at their curated list of the vendors that they have brought in this year, okay? And put that name for name, pound for pound, against any of the other food festivals that come to our city, whether it's the recently LA Wine and Food Festival, which was absolutely awesome, that happened in Santa Monica. There was Masters of Taste that just happened at the Rose Bowl, which was also fantastic. There's EatsCon, which also gets super creative every year. Pound for pound, Coachella's food roster can go toe-to-toe with any of them. I really mean it. And I think that if you're going and you're not that excited about the music, you're in luck, because the food is absolutely going to blow your socks off, okay? For everybody who's going and is overwhelmed by all the choices, don't worry. I've done the work for you, okay? I'm going to tell you really quickly about my top five spots that I'm most excited to check out when I actually go to Coachella for weekend two. And I will be reporting back on how these places are. First is a spot that's doing authentic Jordanian shawarma from cooks who actually trained in Amman and have been importing spices, bread, and equipment to bring us authentic Jordanian shawarma. And I've had Mediterranean on the brain ever since I spoke with the former Top Chef winner, Charbel Hayek, and eating at his restaurant, Lady Hawk. This is a pop-up called Mia Mia, and they'll be serving shawarma at Coachella. They hand make their sauce bread, and they also have za'atar dusted fries. I mean, I love a loaded fry, as you'll learn from the rest of my picks here. To have that at Coachella sounds like an absolute dream. Mia Mia, my number one recommendation for Coachella. Number two, okay, is a Filipino pop-up called Mano Po. Look, Filipino food, all the rage right now in Los Angeles, right? Kuya Lord just got nominated for a James Beard Award for Best Chef California. Well, Mano Po is sort of like what Kuya Lord used to be, right, in its earlier days. You know, this is Kuya Lord at the pop-up stage with some interesting sort of like takes on like fusion fast food as well. Yes, they're doing like classic Filipino favorites like long silog and chicken in asal. However, they are also doing a longanisa smash burgers and other types of dishes like that. I think this is going to absolutely hit the spot. I cannot wait. Third up, Battambang Barbecue. Okay, Battambang Barbecue. It's a Cambodian barbecue spot. Basically, it's a pit master. His name is Chad Fong. I believe they're from Long Beach, actually. And he's fusing Cambodian flavors with Texas smoked barbecue. This looks absolutely incredible. Yes, they've got brisket, they've got tri-tip, they've got baby back ribs, but I think they've also got some interesting sides that really bring in sort of that like Cambodian flair. I can't wait to try this. And by the way, all these three vendors I just mentioned, they're also available at Smorgasburg more often than not. So if you can't go to Coachella, mark these down and go try them at Smorgasburg sometime. The final two concepts I want to talk about are actually brought to us by a chef who many of you will recognize his name. It's Eric Greenspan. Eric Greenspan, I was at lunch with a chef recently, and they asked me, hey, do you know who Eric Greenspan is? And I was like, yeah, he's the grilled cheese guy, right? And they kind of like rolled their eyes at me because, yes, Eric Greenspan is, quote unquote, the grilled cheese guy. He's a guy who started a really popular place. I want to say it was called The Foundry on Melrose, and which is now closed, but it was famous for their grilled cheese. It was featured on a lot of television shows. But the thing you don't realize when you reduce Eric Greenspan to the grilled cheese guy is that this is a serious chef. He trained in New York under chefs like Alain Ducasse, Rocco Despirito. He also apprenticed at the three-star Michelin restaurant El Bulli in Rosa, Spain, under the legendary Ferran Adrià. This is not just like a grilled cheese chef, okay? This is a high-caliber chef who just happens to like making things like grilled cheeses. Well, he is piloting three concepts at Coachella. One is a grilled cheese concept, which like, okay, let's let him have it. He's the grilled cheese guy. He can pilot it there if he wants. I'm not super excited about that one, although, you know, I'm not going to turn my nose up at it if I get the opportunity to have it. The two other concepts he's piloting are really interesting. One is called Chipapas, and it is a basically a concept centered around salchipapas, which are popular South American street food, which basically involve putting chopped hot dogs or sausages on French fries. It's like the most deranged, loaded fries you could possibly imagine. And what he's going to do, he's going to be taking these fries, he's going to be seasoning them with tajine and Old Bay. He's going to put them, he's going to coat them in American cheese sauce, and then he's going to put on fried hot dogs and chorizo Beyond sausages. If you're a vegetarian, there's a carnitas option, and then there's going to be sauces like salsa verde, mayo, ketchup. I think there's also the opportunity to add a sunny side up egg. I've heard rumors, and honestly, if that's the truth, I can barely contain my excitement. Chipapas, I'm calling it right now. This is going to be a concept that lives on way beyond Coachella. I foresee definitely a stall at Smorgasburg in the future, and maybe even a brick and mortar. I think we need Chipapas in the city, and I believe that Eric Greenspan can be the man to bring them to us. Okay, the final concept I want to talk about is also an Eric Greenspan concept, and that is Grinds. Okay, this is simple. It's a Hawaiian concept that basically he calls a quote-unquote love letter to Hawaiian plate lunch culture, okay? You're going to be getting your sweet and sour barbecue grilled chicken. You're going to be getting your unagi glazed slow-cooked pork, your vegan teriyaki, jackfruit, if that's your thing. And you're going to be getting your sides, right? Your macaroni salads. It's all going to be served on Hawaiian rolls. I love this because I think there is a dearth of cool modern Hawaiian joints in Los Angeles. I went to one with Father Saul in Seattle called Marination, and it absolutely blew my mind. I was like, if something like this existed in Los Angeles, I would go every day. Here's my second prediction. Yes, we're going to get a Chipapas in Los Angeles someday. We're also going to get a Grinds, okay? Los Angeles needs a fantastic Hawaiian fast casual concept that's high quality, imaginative, but still scratching that traditional Hawaiian plate lunch itch. We need it. Eric Greenspan, we're here for it, okay? Those are my top five bites that I'm excited for at Coachella. I'll be reporting back on how they actually hit. But if you're going, dear listener, drop me a note because I would love to hear what your favorite bites are that you have at the festival. Finally, before we move on to Daniele, I just wanted to say there is another reason we have Daniele on the podcast today. There is a very special event coming to LA Live at the end of the month, and that is Pizza City Fest. It's the second edition. If you recall, one of the very first episodes of this podcast was with James Beard Award-winning writer Steve Dolinsky. He is the pizza guru who basically came all the way from Chicago to give us this event at LA Live. And it is truly an event that is one of a kind. It's all the best pizzerias you can imagine from the Southland converging on LA Live. There will also happen to be a couple panel discussions with your boy, Luca Servodio, the host of the LA Food Podcast, hosting one and moderating one of the panels. I'll be moderating the panel on Sunday. I think that's April the 28th, if I'm not mistaken. It's going to be a panel on pizza as art in the age of social media. Okay, I've got some incredible guests on the panel. There's going to be Justin DeLeon from Apollonia's Pizza. There's going to be Thomas McNaughton from Flour and Water up in San Francisco. And there's going to be Ines Ballerin from Lupacotta, which is one of the most like sensational mouth-watering pizza projects you can actually come across on Instagram. I highly recommend you all go check it out. We're going to be talking about, yes, how you make pizza sexy taste-wise, but also how you can make it sexy looks-wise in the age of social media. We'll be talking about sort of like the difference between what it is to be an artist and an artisan when it comes to food. And we're also going to talk about one of my favorite topics, which is influence. Who holds influence in the age of social media? You know, how do you use it to leverage your business? And how much do you want to sort of play the influence game? You know, one of my favorite questions. Anyways, make sure you get your tickets for that. It's all available online. We'll be dropping the link in the show notes. That's probably enough for today. Please drop me any thoughts you have on David Chang, on LA Taco, and of course on the Coachella lineup. And without further ado, let's go to Daniele Uditi. Dear listener, my wife recently decided to start eating meat after more than 15 years of being a vegetarian, and being the conscientious consumer that I am, I've been looking for ways to make our household's meat consumption as high quality and sustainable as possible. That's why I'm absolutely thrilled to have found First Light Farms, a small collective of passionate family farmers in New Zealand who are quietly changing the world. Not only are they producing the most tender, rich, and succulent Wagyu beef money can buy, but you can rest assured that First Light's cattle were raised as nature intended, living it up on lush pasture, eating a 100% grass diet with absolutely no grains, no animal byproducts, and no feedlots. The result is the best tasting meat in the game, full of natural marbling and packed with omega-3 fats. If you've ever enjoyed a meal at Matu in Beverly Hills, then you know exactly what I'm talking about. Matu famously sources all of its meat directly from First Light, and the good news is that you too can have First Light Farms meats delivered straight to your door. All you have to do is visit www.firstlight.farm, where you can buy their meats and also sign up for their members-only steak club. Members of the steak club enjoy tons of benefits, including monthly shipments of steaks, access to the highest marble score meats, and, this is my favorite part, access to First Light's full library of proprietary recipes and techniques. Also, you can cook the perfect steak within the comfort of your own home. Buying good steak isn't easy and it isn't cheap. First Light delivers the highest quality at an incredible deal, and now that I've seen the light, I'm never going back. Visit www.firstlight.farm to learn more and use the code LAFOOD10 for a 10% discount on your first order. Guys, I am beyond excited today because we are joined today by none other than Los Angeles's Prince of Pizza and King of Carbohydrates. He's the mastermind behind the Pizzana Neo-Neapolitan Pizza Empire, Caserta's favorite son, Daniele Uditi. Daniele, how you doing today, buddy?
What a presentation. Oh my God, what an introduction, dude. Oh my God.
You weren't expecting that, huh?
Not at all. I feel the pressure, the pre. Nah, I'm merely a cook. So that's how I like to describe myself.
Yeah, all right. I'll keep calling you the king of carbohydrates for you then. Daniele, where are you calling us from today?
We are in my little office in my house in a non-disclosure location.
A non-disclosure location. Okay, without telling us exactly where you are, what kind of restaurants do you like to visit around where you live?
Well, there is, if I tell you the my favorite place to go, people figure out, well, who cares? I'm in Simi Valley, so let's say that. But Simi Valley doesn't have that many, like, super high-end restaurant. But there's one of my favorite shop over here that I think they make one of the best bread in the world. It's called the Baker's Daughter. And that's where I go get coffee and bread or sandwich or some focaccia. There's a beautiful family, a Brazilian family, and Yasmin, Maria, and Rafael. Rafael actually lives in Brazil, so the daughters make the bread. So that's my, actually, I believe that's one of the best bread in Los Angeles.
Why? What makes their bread so special?
It's just, first of all, I lost a lot of weight, and if it wasn't for that bread, that doesn't spike your glycemic to the roof because it's a long fermentation like I like, and you know, and the flavor, the sour flavor is good. It's not that super sour flavor that everybody is so obsessed in the US. The sourdough has to be super sour. No, yeah. There has to be a balance for me when you have sourdough, and you have to taste the flour, but it doesn't have to take away from the experience of bread. So it's an amazing balanced product, and I think also the love that they use, like when they welcome you in, and the way they are set up. I like everything about that place. So,
I was just talking about that with my wife, actually. That hospitality, just like the art of like saying hello, making people feel welcome, it's kind of a dying thing, don't you think?
I blame the fact that people are on the phone too much. So people don't have a span of attention anymore. And even though sometimes when you want to talk to a table, not always, but maybe with a younger generation, there's like very little words that you can say. But I found myself very easy to talk with people like they are a little bit mature. You know, I don't want to use the word old, but you know, I can tell stories. I can introduce myself, a couple of jokes. Maybe I'm getting old. That's why I don't get that much the young generation. But it's not true. There is also a lot of people that visit Pizzana that are very young and they're excited. And I find myself like talking. I think taking the time to actually talk to somebody and listen to what somebody has to say is something that is precious. And it's slowly fading away. So what I do, I like to talk. So you can see, I talk to people. I like to tell stories. I like to give information and take information. I think it's one of the most beautiful things, especially in this industry.
Well, I think so. What you're describing is something that is probably very telling of the part of the world that you come from, right? Because you're a long way from home right now, but if you're from a part of Italy where that is very much the norm, right? People stop, they talk, they have a conversation, they like to know what's going on in each other's lives, for better or for worse. So let's go back there for a moment. You're a long way from where you grew up, and I think a lot of times you get labeled as Neapolitan, but you're not quite from Naples, are you?
I was born in Naples. I was born in Naples because all my family's from Naples. And because my family bought a piece of land in Caserta, more on the countryside, I grew up between the two cities, Naples and Caserta. So I like to call myself Napo Casertano. So it's Neapolitan and from Caserta. And I love both realms. So it's you got the city, the metropolis, there is Naples. I won't really call it metropolis because Naples is more romantic. Metropolis, you imagine these traffic things, and we take a lot of poetic licenses, even on driving and on the traffic, so in Naples. And Caserta is more like a bird waking up in the morning, at least where I grew up, the countryside.
Because there's also the city part of Caserta too, right?
Yeah, which is beautiful, where the royal palace is, where the Reggia is, and it's unbelievable. Caserta, I think, is one of the most underrated city in the world for the patrimony that it has, for the ingredients that it has, for the story. That there is so much good in Caserta, and I think people just have to take the time to discover.
So, I mean, obviously, we hear all the time about Italian products, right? We hear about San Marzano tomatoes, right, and things like that. What is a product that's from Caserta, which Americans might know, that you are particularly proud of?
Guys, come on. It's one of the staples in the world. It's mozzarella di bufala campana DOP, which one of the best for me is from Caserta. But, of course, there is different schools. There's different schools. There's from Caserta, which I think is the best, at least for my flavor profile. Then there is the one from Battipaglia, which is more leaning to Salerno. But I can say the best mozzarella di bufala maker are from Caserta, and one of my favorite is La Baronia from the Cutillo family, which I happen to grow up with, and to me is one of the best. And I serve that Pizzana when the tomatoes are good.
Only when the tomatoes are good. You can't do it when the tomatoes are bad, right?
If I have to serve a caprese, you need a good tomatoes. So if in winter tomatoes are not there, we just take it off of the menu.
Now, so when we're talking about what makes good mozzarella di bufala, are we talking about the actual buffaloes, what they're eating, or the actual way it's produced? Like, is it a little bit of both?
It's, you know, there's a lot of big establishment that just go out there and buy the milk, right? So, and there is very few that, they still buy the milk, but also they do their own self-produce, like cows, like they roam. The magic for me was to see Don Alfonso Cutillo taking me where he has these buffalo going they're still secure, but they're in the wild, and he communicated with them like come here and the buffalo come here, it showed to me that they're very high scared animals. So every movement, they will run away. So you have to be very gentle, very calm around them, you know. And to me, it was one of the most beautiful connecting moments that I had with the product, because you see the animal and then at the end you appreciate it more when mm-hmm. you actually taste it. And also, for sure, there is the artisanal part behind, which are their masters. It's been like passed by family to family to family, and see their father working with their kids now, and their kids were showing me how to the mozzarella by hand. And people think it's easy. It's not easy. I did a lot of fail time. Like, I was trying to do the star that you do with by pinching them. Wasn't for me. I said, you guys are good at this, keep doing it for me, and I love you to the end of the world.
And I'll worry about the dough. Now, speaking of family though, if I'm not mistaken, your family is in the culinary industry, right?
Yeah, well, my mom was a chef, and my grandpa was a pastry chef on cruise ships. So, he used to do these big parties and stuff. But also, my grandpa did so many jobs. Like, my grandpa was a kid of the war, right? Like, right after the World War II, he was there. Like, so he lived it. So he was telling me a lot of story when he had to walk from northern Italy to back to home. He did it by walking. It took him like three months, and because he was kept in a camp after the war, for security measurement. So he got tired of the camp. He escaped, and he had to go by walking. That was his childhood. So my grandpa. And then he started to do a lot of jobs. He started as to work at a pier by taking stuff out of the boats, and then butcher, and then he went back to the pier. Eventually, he learned how to make pastries, and he used to work on cruise ships making big parties and piping cakes. Like, so there's nobody business.
That's crazy. So, and then did he eventually settle and start his own bakery, or how did that come?
No. My grandpa, after that, went to pension and decided that he wanted to teach me how to make pastries. But because my grandpa was very strict, I hated every minute of it. So I said, I love eating your pastry, but I hate doing it. So pastry is not going to be something that I will learn. But eventually something stuck with me. I learned how to do a little bit of pastry too from him, like pastiera napoletana, the sfogliatelle, the babà, all the classic Neapolitan desserts. And in my family, when my first brother got married, his mother-in-law was she's a baker. She had a bakery, and I was very little when they engaged and went together. So for me, Michelina, which is the name, is my auntie. So I only know her as Auntie Michelina, Zia Michelina, and she taught me everything I know about bread and pizzas and focaccias, and because she used to run an underground forno.
It's
a bakery, but it's more like on top you leave, and underneath they had the basement where they had the wood fire oven, and they will make product, like a very, very ancient oven, and they used to make bread and oven product, pizza nel ruoto, long focaccias, pane cafone, canestrato San Marchese, which is the bread of San Marco Evangelista, where I grew up. And I learned everything from her. She used to bake and then deliver in the little apecar, to all the salumeria, all the salumerias in the town, which in English is deli, I think. But deli is a little bit reductive for what a salumeria is in Italy.
Yeah. The Salumeria is more like a place you go to shop for products like the cold cut, as opposed to where you're getting the sandwiches, which is what happens in America with the delis, right?
Yeah. But in Salumeria, you can also do the sandwich. But the sandwich in Italy, especially in the south, it's a rosetta or a palatella, which is like 3/4 of a piece of bread. They open up and they put mortadella and some cheese. That's it. There's no vinegar. There's no... Not like the Padrino I do over here. The Padrino was inspired from one of the best sandwiches in town, which is Bay Cities. I had that sandwich and I said I could do a version of that sandwich, but with all high quality Italian ingredients. So that's what I did.
Yeah, and I love the Padrino. I think it's the best Italian sandwich in Los Angeles. And I'm not just saying that because you're on my podcast. I've literally said that on the lists I published too. But I was just thinking, I've heard so much about what Americans think about sandwiches that I think if they went to Caserta or Napoli and they had one of those panini from the Salumeria, they would be like, what the hell is this? Where's my sauce? Where's my pickle?
Well... there's no sauce, no pickles, nothing. But, if you want to do a resemblance of that, if you put some peperonata inside and a cheese, a cutlet, cotoletta e peperoni, it's something more wet that they might appreciate. But you know what I found? I found that when they go in Italy, because the brain is connected to the land, they don't complain about it. So they accept what it is and they say it's like oh god, this is so delicious, it's amazing. The problem is when you come back over here, because when you're over here it's like you play in your house, you jog in cast.
Here you can get the same thing, but for example it's a good sandwich spot and they do things relatively simply. It's Sogno Toscano over in Montana. Mm-hmm. But some people I've gone with walk away pretty disappointed because the sandwiches are so simple and they're really expensive here because they're getting it's good product, right?
Yeah.
So it's hard to replicate here the same experience, right?
It's very, very hard, but not for the quality side. It's very hard for the price point. Price point is, especially right now, produce is going to the roof. Everything is it's rising, and it's very difficult. So even though I charge for the Padrino like $18, like $18 for a sandwich, but I don't use prosciutto cotto or mortadella that is made with serum, to enhance the big, like you have more product, but at the end of the day you're eating more oil or more water in the dough. So it's product by weight and it costs a lot of money. So one of my favorite sandwich shop in Los Angeles is the Beverly's Cheese Store, and Dominic does a fantastic job on importing so many little treasures of Italy. The prosciutto crudo that he has, very high, like old aged, super aged. The mortadella that he imports is amazing. The guanciale that you had, the carbonara that I made at Pizzana, it was from his shop, and also other beautiful product. But then at the end of the day, you see the price and say, "Oh my God, it's so expensive!" Because it costs a lot of money to make and for the quality. And if you want to eat high quality food, not necessarily you have to spend a fortune, but it's not cheap.
Well, and also the thing you're not saying about your padrinos, you're making the bread, you're making the spianata in-house too.
Yeah.
So you also got to factor in labor, and labor's not cheap these days either.
Not at all, especially in Los Angeles. Like, labor keeps going high and high and high and high and high. So and even though it's $18 as a sandwich, trust me, I'm undercharging because there is almost no profit to that sandwich.
Wow, that's crazy. Almost no profit to that sandwich. Wow. Well, hey, let's go back to simpler times, right? Let's go back to when you were a kid, because I've heard you talk about this before, how you were excited to work in the bakery because you like to play with the sticky stuff, right? What did you like about that? I mean, to me, it sounds, when I was 12, I want to play video games. I wanted to be outside playing soccer. I didn't want to be in a dark room with a fire playing with dough.
Trust me, my childhood wasn't all childhood labor. Don't worry about it. So I was I was treated very, very nice by my family. It's but at the end of the day, you live in a house where there is an oven underneath, and you know, where you see my brother helping his mother-in-law making the bread, and Freselle, oh my God, the Freselle that we used to make, like the double-baked bread. So you wake up in the morning because you hear the noise, it's like 4 a.m., and you go and get a glass of water, and then you see everybody having fun, like laughing and making jokes and listening to music and, you know, and mixing this dough and getting all sticky. And as a 9 years old, what do you do? It's like, oh, it's dirty, first of all. It's a mess. Second, yeah. I said, what do you want to do? I want to play with it too. It's like kids nowadays play with slimes. Making dough was my slime because it was everywhere. And, you know, at 9 years old, I didn't even reach the madia, the container where you used to make the bread. So they had to put like 2 cases of water underneath me to just touch it. And I wasn't really mixing. I was playing with them. They gave me a little piece of dough and I was with them. But the more I grew, my first job was actually overseeing the baking process and cleaning the oven. So I started to bake my first loaf. I was like 10 years old, 10, 11 years old. And it was beautiful. I could see the romanticism. Right now is romanticism because the story. As a kid, you don't understand. But each loaf of bread didn't have a bannetton like French, everybody, that you put the bread inside to proof. No, had linens, like cotton linens, cut it in squares. And you put flowers in this linen, a cotton linen, put the dough in it, and then you tie it, a knot. And then you leave it in the basement in la cantina to ferment for the next day. And then the next day you bake, and you see this scene. Like, my auntie is super, very religious, as every old ladies in southern Italy. So open up the cloth, the oven was ready, take off the ashes out, then open up the cloth of bread and cut it with a cross.
Oh,
and
wow.
Every time she cut the bread with the cross, she had to say a prayer. Like, you will hear this, like, Padre nostro che sei in cielo, santificato sia il tuo nome, and the bread will go in the oven.
I get that. I'll tell you a story quickly, Daniela. When I moved to Los Angeles, I missed my grandmother and my mom's pizza. So I tried to make pizza for the first time. I'd never made it. I was around it all the time, but I was never interested in learning. I was just always interested in mettere dentro la canna, or to eat it, as we say. And basically, I tried to make the pizza, and I didn't realize that you had to let it rise, right, the first time. So I made it, and it was this cracker, right? And I was so sad. I was so depressed. Second time, I try again the next day. I let it rise, and my initial instinct when I saw the dough rise, I said a prayer. I wasn't even religious. I just said a prayer. I think it's that Italian in you, something about you, just like
it is.
It's you could see how like the world of the spirit is connected to the food. It's just in us, you know.
Yeah. No, it's magical. It's like, could we do this process a little faster? And my auntie was like, no, the bread has to be blessed, which is in Casertano, in close to Neapolitan language. She will say, "O pane santa benedisce." Il pane si deve benedire. The bread has to be blessed. So each loaf of bread will be blessed with a cross and a little prayer, and then go in the oven. Then you close this oven and you don't see anything for at least an hour. 1 hour, yeah. You don't see anything. Then you open up and you see all this beautiful loaf of bread baked to perfection. And when I came in the US, I asked, it was like, I need a recipe. And the recipe on my auntie, you want to know what it is? Oh, you put a box and a half of salt, a punch of the crescito. But what if I had to do double batch? 2 punches, put 2 punches of crescito. So I had to work again with her in old age and follow each steps. And before she does the step, said, wait, I need to wait this so I can take the recipe. And she was like, ah, wait, you're making me lose time. I'm old now. I can be dead any minute. So that is my auntie.
I relate. Before my grandmother passed, I spent an entire summer with her in the kitchen, and I didn't tell her like that she had to do anything differently, right? But I was just like, I'm gonna shadow you, and I'm going to write down all the recipes as you're doing them and collect them for myself. Yeah, that was the hardest job I ever had, man. Just following an old nonna around the kitchen, trying to decipher like, wait, how much oil? Wait, this time you did it this way. Why the next time you did it a different way? You know, just like making sense of it. It's just like translating gibberish. You feel it. It's a feeling, not a recipe.
I say this, you know, a lot of people, and I think there is nothing wrong to be over scientific on things, especially when you bake and make bread. But when they ask me and the process, my process of cooking and baking, I call it gut feeling. You feel it. Yeah, that's how I learned, and that's I literally call it gut feeling cooking. That's what I do, because that's how my mom used to cook. That's how my auntie used to make bread. Used to make, because she doesn't make anymore, but she's still alive, thank God. So that's the only person that used to measure everything was my grandpa, because bakery and making pastry and cakes requires extreme precision. Yeah. But I grew up with my mom in the kitchen, and my mom was like tasting every 5 minutes what she was doing and throwing ingredient in a pot, almost like when you see Remy in a Ratatouille movie making the soup. It's like, ooh, ooh. That's the scene that I have of my mom cooking. And somehow it was always the same.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's all sometimes different processes, always the same. Well, look, you grew up in and around this world. At what point did you decide, I want to do this for a living?
Well, it was a second nature. So I saw my mom always cooking, and I loved it. And I just knew that I wanted to do this. I think I always had it since the first moment that I started to play with the sticky stuff. But then it's different when you work with your family and then you go out and work with somebody else. Like to make pizza, I went around different places to learn pizza, which is different than the recipe of bread. It comes always from bread, but it's different from the way I used to work with the bakery, which when you make bread, there is no pressure of the ordering tickets, right? Because you make all the bread in the morning, you make a certain quantity, and then you sell out, and your job is done. But then when you work in an establishment where you have people paying at the moment and ordering the food that has to be done in a certain amount of time, that comes pressures, and that comes skills and other stuff. And that has to be learned, like being quick on stretching, slapping the pizza, putting ingredients, and figure out the way the ticket works. Oh, this was first, this was last. That was difficult. Especially, think about it, in summer, I used to go making pizza in places where there is high numbers of people, right? Like summer jobs. And we used to make like 1,200, 1,500 pizza a day. And it was nuts. Like, it was crazy. But also was the best time of my life. You know why? Because I had so much joy and so many laughs about it. That is...
Is it like the... Also, when you're getting slammed like that, and it's so high volume, and it's so busy and so difficult, I'm assuming it also creates a special type of camaraderie with the people you're doing 100%. It with.
100%. And one of the guys that first taught me how to make pizza, which is unfortunately passed away very young, was Umberto Persichini, and I like to remember him. We had this job in Caserta in a place called La Fazenda with the owner that I still talk to him, Simone Gallo. He's just an amazing guy. He treated me always like a son. I used to go and make pizza in the in the pizza place, you know, and then because I kind of know how to sing Neapolitan, old Neapolitan song. So in the room, we used to go back in the on the floor, and I said, Daniela, there is a computer over there. Go to karaoke. So I didn't have to clean. So I left the pizza master over there to clean after me, and I was singing Neapolitan songs to entertain the people in the pizza place in Caserta. So it's just an amazing time. And one last thing, let me say about Umberto. Umberto was the happiest people and the nicest pizza chef I ever met in my life, and taught me so much about the speed and how to make pizza, how to use an oven that you can put inside 14, 15 pizza. It was huge, the oven, and cook them. So I respect Umberto a lot.
That sounds like a very, very good, healthy, happy environment to be in. At what point were you like, I'm going to leave this and go to America?
Well, it wasn't. That's a hard story. But if you have a little bit of time, I can tell you. It wasn't the happiest story. While I was working in this place in Caserta, unfortunately, my mom got cancer and she passed away when I was 23. And it happened to be then a friend of my ex-boss in Caserta had a spot. He was going to open up a spot here in the US, in Santa Monica, to be precise. And he said to his friends, like, do you have a pizza chef? Because I have a pizza program that I would love to. I would love to go. So he asked me if I would love to. I would have loved to go in the U.S. and make pizza. And honestly, I said yes right away because I couldn't live in the same house where I grew up with my mom. So it was for me a little bit, okay, let's change it. But when I came over here, there was no, like, basically told me, okay, give me this. I will do the papers. I will do this. I will do that. And then after 6 months, I discovered that I was living here with an expired tourist visa.
Wow. Yeah. So you were here for 6 months, and were you helping out at the project?
No, I lived in a van on Venice Beach for 6.5 months. Things evolved, you know. This story I told this story so many times right now.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Things evolved, and meanwhile I was working in that place. I happened to be like an article on the LA magazine, and after that article, a lot of celebrities started to come to the restaurant, and one of these celebrities was Chris O'Donnell, and he helped me out so much in the beginning of. I used to go to his house and do pizza party on Sundays, and he used to talk about me to all his friends, and I made pizza for huge names. I'm lucky to be a friend with Jennifer Garner, and I made pizza for Gwyneth Paltrow, Jon Favreau, of course, they came to the restaurants, and so many others. But Chris O'Donnell helped me. I will never forget what Chris O'Donnell and his family did for me, because in one of these party I actually met Candice and Charles Nelson, which are my business partner at Pizzana.
Yeah, I mean, that's incredible. I mean, yeah, you're right. You told that story a lot of times, and it's an incredible story. I mean, going from being in your van, Venice Beach, to then cooking for all these celebrities, to then having the opportunity to start your own pizza place, it's a true, like, American dream kind of story. Let's talk about the pizza, though, because when you got to Los Angeles, what was the pizza scene like? What was your understanding of pizza in Los Angeles when you got here?
Well, first pizza I had was the chain pizzas. It was Papa John's, it was Domino, it was all these pizza, which is, honestly, if I had to tell you terrible things about it, I will not. But the only thing that I felt after eating those pizza is that after you eat those pizza and drink a glass of water, I felt a little sick. Like, it was very difficult to process for the body. And I couldn't eat anything all day. Like it was nuts. I felt always like burping. I was oh my god, what's this sensation of heaviness that I have on my stomach? And I ate a couple of times, and then I say, okay, I'm not gonna eat anymore. And since then, I never ate it anymore. But flavor profile, if I had to tell you, oh my god, it's terrible. No, it's not terrible. It's it's an okay pizza for me, but being used to it on Italian pizza with high quality ingredients, it was like a shock. But then I experienced Nancy Silverton pizza, Mozza. And at the time when I, now it's been a long time that I don't go to Mozza, because I go here and there because I like it. You know, I tasted that pizza and a lot of people, a lot of Italians especially, would tell, ah, that's not pizza, that's not something. There's not even Italian pizza, and Italian took it in a way. But honestly, when I tasted it, I think it was delicious, and it reminded me of forno pizza, like the one that you buy in a salumeria. Actually, it's very bready, super light, and well baked. You know, it was different, of course. But the thought process behind, I loved it. So Mozza was very good for me at the time. And that was my understanding of pizza.
Yeah, I was going to say, that pizza sounds like it was probably right up your alley. Because I remember like when I first went to Mozza myself, I was one of those annoying Italian people being like, ah, no, this is nothing like the stuff we get in Italy. But, you know, now that I have a deeper appreciation for different types of pizzas and whatnot, I can see why that one appealed to you, because the thing that I've often heard said about Nancy's pizza is it's a baker's pizza, right? It's a very like, you know, well thought out dough, very complex dough and flavor, and it's baked well. It's well executed at the end of the day.
I agree, and the ingredients were high quality ingredients, and it was very nice to, it was delicious to eat. So Nancy was and still is one of my favorite chefs in Los Angeles. So,
but that was really one of the only quote unquote games in town. There were other pizzerias here and there. I remember a good pizza back in 2013 in Los Feliz called Mother Dough, which I liked quite a bit.
I never had the chance to go in there, but a lot of people was telling me that it was a good pizza.
Yeah, that was probably, if somebody, you know, gun to the head, 2013, that was my favorite pizza in town.
Mm-hmm.
But then after that went away, I think he closed it up in 2015 or so, because he was doing it by himself. He just couldn't do it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
We kind of went through a little bit of a pizza desert there, as far as I'm concerned. You know, there was not as much pizza as there is today until 2017. Something happened in Brentwood. A little sign went up. It said Pizzana, and then all of a sudden, there's this pizza that hits the street. Of course, there's a lot of work that went into that, too. I want to hear quickly about how you sort of conceptualized the idea behind Pizzana, because it would have been very easy for you to just start a very traditional Neapolitan pizza spot, do it exactly like they do it in Naples. Why didn't you do that?
The experience that I had by eating pizza in Los Angeles was that people like the pizza to have a texture, right? So when you have a pizza that is too floppy, it's called soupy. Like, people will send it back. Like, in my first job, that's what I was experiencing. So I went back, and I remember the time that we used to make pizza with leftover bread dough at my auntie, in the oven of my auntie. And because the oven didn't reach the same temperature that pizza, Neapolitan pizza, has to be cooked in, it was more around 600 Fahrenheit, 550 Fahrenheit, 600 Fahrenheit, the pizza had longer time to bake, and it actually was crunchy, it was crispy. It was still resembled Neapolitan pizza, but it was... It had texture, you know, things didn't fall off. And that's what I wanted to do at Pizzana. I went back to a childhood memory, and I knew right away that was what I wanted to do. So that's the first thing that made me want to do what I did, what I'm doing every day at Pizzana. The second one, I have to give credit to Candice and Charles and the team behind it, because, you know, alone you can do so many things. But when you, I've been blessed to be meeting two of the most amazing people in this industry. Candice and Charles Nelson are a dream partner. Like, you cannot, like, wish best to work with. Like, I had and I still have the time of my life anytime I work with them. So, and because they are very American, you can understand right away what works and what doesn't work.
Yeah.
You know, so that inspired me. My childhood memory, but also having this shock of culture by serving it to a very traditional American.
So what did you have to do in order to develop the dough that you thought would be perfect for Pisana?
Well, first of all, I came with my auntie starter, my auntie's sourdough, but it's not really a sourdough. It's called crescido. Crescido is basically like a sourdough, but has salt in it to control the pH. So the pizza doesn't go super sour. Actually retains a little bit of the sweetness. So and that will give the distinct flavor to Pizzana pizza, to my pizza. And then I started to bake it, and it just clicked. It just was great.
And in terms of toppings and stuff, I remember one of the ones that Jonathan Gold wrote about was this Neo Margarita and whatnot. How did you develop sort of the ideas for all the toppings, and what was your goal there?
Well, I noticed that everybody was starting to play around with classic ingredients, especially in the motherland. And I said, why not making my version of margarita? Like, a lot of people are doing it. I want to do it too. So I want to try to see if I can improve the lack of basil on a margarita. Because every time you eat a margarita, there's always two or three leaves scattered, and you don't get always the three flavor in each bite, right? So I said, okay, let's fix this problem, if there is a problem. I don't think it's a problem, but for me, it was. So instead of just having tomato sauce as a base, I did the fior di latte as a base, and then the San Marzano we cooked for a very long time, so it becomes almost like a paste. We call it polpa because you still see the wetness inside and the pulp of the tomato. And then on top, we finish it just with basil dust, I call it, like a basil powder that we make in house.
Take me back to the night, let's say, that Pizzana, the first location in Brentwood, opened. Were you nervous? Were you nervous that this idea wasn't going to work?
I was very worried about do people are gonna show up, and we actually had a very slow lunch. Like the lunch was very slow, but then something happened that this amazing human being showed up at our restaurant, and his name was Jonathan Gold. And Jonathan Gold, which I didn't know who he was at the time, just sat down at Pizzana, and I cooked his pizzas, and I stopped talking to him. I stopped at the table talking to him, and he told me so much about Los Angeles and the food scenes. But we were just talking. We weren't even talking about the pizza. He wasn't making one appreciation to anything. He was just genuinely interested on hearing me and my story. And he kept eating the pizza. The one that he loved the most is the cacio e pepe, which he called the small miracle. And after he ate three times at Pizzana, he came up with this beautiful article, which is a love letter. It's not even an article. And after that article, we had like so many people showing up every day.
What was that like to read that article for you?
I cried. I'm not ashamed to say I cried, because think about it. I went from hell to be praised by one of the best culinary writers that ever existed in the world. And for him to say that my pizza is one of the best in the world, I mean, I have to breathe because tears are gonna start showing up, and I don't like crying on camera. So yeah. I can never thank Jonathan Gold enough, and what he did for me, for Pizzana, for all of us. Because think about it, Pizzana now has 6 locations and another one opening up to Houston. So think about how many people we give work to, mm-hmm. and how many opportunity of work, how many family lives out of it. I'm very proud of my team because they don't come just for the money. Every person that work with me is in love with what they do. So, and I cannot be more blessed about it.
Absolutely. Well, it takes a team, but it starts at the top, man. So congratulations. Well, we talked a little bit about it, right? We talked about the fact that LA, we're not going to call it a pizza desert, but it was not a city that was known for its pizza, mm-hmm. right? And you have Pizzana in 2017. The success continues 2018, 2019. We see other Pizzana locations spot up, but we also see this trend, if you want to call it, of a lot of different types of pizzas and pizzerias mm-hmm. popping up. I think it's been called a renaissance, and I believe somebody has even dubbed you the godfather of Los Angeles pizza renaissance. I'm not saying you did that yourself. I know you don't even like the title, but it's been thrown out there, okay? What do you think about what's happened, the boom that's happened in Los Angeles pizza over the last 5 to 7 years?
Well, first of all, I thank you for calling me that, but it's even though people tell me that I was the one that started everything, this so-called renaissance, I believe that pizza, passion for pizza was in there already for people. And if Pizzana helped Los Angeles to be one of the pizza city, I'm honored, honestly. And if a concept works, of course people get ideas and they want to try and do the same thing but with their own twist. So, and honestly, I have enjoyed a lot of places that open up with stunning, amazing pizza. You know, one pizza place that I love the most, and it's not even Italian style, is Detroit. I don't even know if you call it Detroit at this point, but it's Apollonia.
Mm-hmm.
Apollonia is one of my favorite pizza in Los Angeles. It's I think it's just amazing. There's another one in Orange County that I like. It's called Folks mm-hmm. Pizzeria, which is truly amazing. There is one in West Hollywood. It's called Ronan. Ronan does not just pizza, but they make amazing little plate and appetizers, and the pizza is great. And then, you know, there is so many others. Gra, which is Gra pizza, is it's amazing too. There's so many great pizza spots right now in Los Angeles that I don't think we cannot be called anymore the taco city. You know, Los yeah. Angeles is a pizza city. It became a pizza city.
I completely agree with that. Now, look, you see a lot of like lists, right? You see a lot of lists like the top 5 pizzas in Los Angeles or the top 10, and you get all these people like yours truly too. So, you know, I'll take a little bit of this blame too, where, you know, people are saying this is the best pizza or this pizza's better than the other. What do you think about this sort of like competition, tribalism that happens around pizza and people being so passionate about what their favorite type of pizza is and almost taking it to the level of like shitting on other types of pizzas because they're so proud of their pizza?
Listen, what can I say? I'm lists and mention are there, you know. This is the social media time and it has to be there. I think it's only normal that people do list, and but they don't have to be taken always super to the letter, right? Because that's what I say. You cannot always make everybody happy. It's impossible. And everybody have their own flavor profile, right? Like when people say pineapple on a pizza, or some people like pineapple on a pizza, and who am I to say that pineapple on a pizza should not go? Like if you like it and it's your preference, it's amazing. I'm happy for you. You know, you like pineapple, it's great. I don't like pineapple, like a margarita with pineapple and ham. It's something that I cannot eat. But if somebody likes it, hey, it's your body, it's your stomach, it's your flavor profile. Do whatever you want with it. It's not. But I do believe that pineapple can be a good ingredient to put on a pizza if paired well. I did a pineapple pizza just, and I called it sacrilegious. I did it on purpose because I wanted to show people that even pineapple can taste delicious on a pizza when treated the right way. But the lists, to go back to the discussion of lists, it's like on 10 people, 10 people are going to have 10 different favorite pizza spots, right?
Yeah,
and then you gotta respect it. You always gotta respect. You can only work hard and hope that people will like what you do. But if you think about it, when you work, and the first thing that you need to think about is the respect of the customer. If you work and think about your customers, and then you wanna serve them the best, that's already a good start. That's how I work. I work because I want high quality product, high quality ingredients, and I want to give the guest the value for their money. Because they come in your place and they spend a few bucks on what you do. The only thing that you can do to respect that, and respecting that, is making food with the most love you can. And that's what I try to do.
I've eaten pizza with you before, and it's always really interesting to see someone like you eat pizza, because you don't eat it like the rest of us, you know, where you're just like taking a bite, enjoying it. You're analyzing it. You're opening up the crust. You're looking inside. You're looking at the bake, right? And I've started doing that too when I eat pizza, just to imitate you. I don't actually know what I'm looking for. So that's what, you know, at least people think I do know what I'm looking for. You take a very inclusive approach to pizza, right? You take a very inclusive approach to restaurant touring in general. You're basically saying, like, you know, as long as you're doing things the right way, you're putting your passion in, you're putting your love in, it, do you, you know, people are going to like what they like, keep going. Do you ever see anything, any sort of behavior in the industry that you don't like, that you're kind of like, that rubs you the wrong way, that you wish would change?
When on the menu you see ingredients not being described the right way. It's like now if I put fior di latte, is fior di latte, we import it from Latteria Sorrentina, from Giovanni Amodio, from a family that does fior di latte from generation. And everybody now writes on the menu fior di latte just for the hell of it. And is basically mozzarella or fresh mozzarella. There's a difference in the product. So just that's what it goes back to, respecting the people, right? So if you charge a certain amount of money for something, and then you just call it the way because it sounds fancy, is something that I don't, that behavior for me is something that I will not do. Like if you use Parmigiano Reggiano, you cannot write. If you use Parmesan, you cannot write Parmigiano Reggiano. Yeah. So that's the, what I like. I like the honesty on what you are selling to the people. Because otherwise, takes the value away from somebody else that actually served that product.
Yeah.
And they think, oh, why you are selling it for this much when I go over there, the same product, and is being charged for so much money. And it's not the same.
Mm-hmm. It's honesty. It comes down to honesty and integrity, right?
That's what I learned from my family, and that's what I will always do.
Well, look, you talk about Pizzana expanding, you know, as you said, it's 6 locations, 7th on the way. I have to ask, what's the goal here? World domination?
No, I mean, that would be interesting.
No, Pizzana Dubai? When is Pizzana Dubai opening?
Listen, this is one of the reasons why I've been enjoying working with my business partner, Kansen Charles, is because the beautiful thing about working with Candace and Charles is that I work and I worry only about the food.
Mm-hmm.
Business side, their domain. So, and when you have this kind of relationship, I think it's a very, very healthy relationship. So I know that there is plan to expand further, but at the moment, my goal, personal goal, is to do the most and as much as I can to keep the quality always the same, which with a lot of location is very, very difficult job, but I try very hard to go always in each location and oversee. And, you know, mistake can happen. You know, sometimes I do have customers like, oh, I didn't have great experience tonight because somebody made a mistake. I make mistakes too. So, but what I do, I try always to go and see my people and say, okay, let me see what's going on. What is maybe you are doing something wrong and correct that mistake. So that's my job right now. World domination is not on the plan yet, but quality control and making sure that people know what they're doing is what I strive the most.
How hard is that? How do you do that? Like, it sounds so tough because I know how much you care about your product, about what you do. It's, and you know, I've even seen you post a social media video about like a salad leaving the kitchen where you're like, salad, I love you. Salad, I don't want you to leave. You know, treat the salad well, server. You know, how do you like tonight, right? You're in California right now. You're gonna have a whole Pizzana team in Dallas doing the job. You're a plane ride away. Surely you get anxiety about that.
I always have anxiety, but I have a lot of video call with them, and you know, they show me, and some every night they send me like a picture of one item made to see if it's been made correctly, and we review with my team. We all review, maybe but there is this how much sauce? No, it was supposed to be this one, because sometimes people, even if you do the same thing all over and over again, sometimes for some reason you go to a certain way without even knowing. So that's why you have to keep always things in check. But yes, it gives me anxiety, but I am lucky enough to work with beautiful people. That's why I say ciao, beautiful people.
Ciao, beautiful people. Daniela, I got to ask, right? You obviously made a big move coming to Los Angeles from Caserta. From Napoli, Casertano, as you call yourself. Do you ever wonder what would have happened if you stayed in Italy?
Probably I will still cook. I will still cook and I will still do this for a living. But I have to say something that is not always true, but it's happens a lot in, especially in southern Italy. Opportunity are less than here. So over here, you might have a little bit more opportunity. That's what happened to me, at least. I can only speak from my experience. But in Italy, at least when I was living there, was a little bit tough to get this kind of opportunity. Somebody that you know, will give you a hand and will invest in you and will believe in you. There's always a little bit of jealousy on what you're trying to do over there. That's something that we need to be better about as Italians, I think. But at the end of the day, I still envision myself cooking and being full of flour and going home and wash my clothes and dough will come out. So that's cook is something that has never been in doubt for me.
Has your auntie who had the bakery been over here to have your pizza?
My auntie, no. My brother, see. My brother, yes. My brother came over here and had the pizza and scarfed down 2-3 pies at the time. It's like, oh my God, we should do this in Italy too. And I say, we think it will work, because in Italy, if you cook the, in Naples, if you cook the pizza too much, you're going to say, oh, it's a biscotto. It's a cookie. And he's like, no, don't worry, but now it's changing. And I do see in Italy too, it's changing. People are researching more of the texture wise, the crunchiness. So a lot of Roman pizza spots in Naples are being opening up in Caserta too.
Wow. Now I've seen everything.
Yep.
Well, I just want to say thank you so much for joining us, for taking the time to join us. I never let people leave without answering one final question. When you look back on all this crazy journey, what are you most proud of?
I should look back more because I usually always see what's next. I always say to myself, I stress out about what's next. But honestly, I should take some victory sometimes. If I had to tell you, I think it's my mom that has been guiding me. Because one thing happened one night in that van while I was crying to myself and say, what am I doing here? I have a job in Italy, I have a house. Why am I all over to the other part of the world and I am living in a van? So I prayed to my mom and I said, listen, if is destiny that I have to be here, if it's fate that guided me here, give me a sign. Like, give me a sign, do something for me. And after 1 week, I said the prayer, I met Chris O'Donnell. I started to have catering business and cooking for celebrities. I met my partners, Candace and Charles. I opened up Pizzana, and now I opened more Pizzana with them, and I've been blessed since then. So I'm proud of being prayed and faithful to my mom, to my family, and to keep my smile all the time, even when I'm under pressure. That's what I'm proud of.
Danye, you're going to make me cry, man. This is not what I signed up for as the podcast host, okay?
Oh, come on.
Hey, Danielle. Well, I just want to say thank you so much for joining us. I'm going to put all the links in the show notes so folks at home can know where to visit you at all of the Pizzana locations, including Pizzana Dubai opening whenever we'll announce it here.
Came from my lips, guys. I don't know. Candace, if you listen to this, it's Luca said it, okay?
Yeah, blame Luca. But Danielle, just thank you for joining us, man.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for everybody to listen.
If there's anybody still listening, of course. No, I'm just kidding.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the LA Food Podcast. And thanks to our guest, Danielle Uditi, for making the time to speak with us. What a delight that guy is, huh, dear listener? And I don't know if I mentioned this, but you know how I mentioned earlier in the podcast that I'm going to be moderating a panel at Pizza City Fest at LA Live later in April? Well, Danielle is also going to be on a panel the day before I moderate mine. It's going to be on the Saturday, which I believe is the 27th, and he's going to be on a panel called The Dough Whisperers with our friend of the pod, Karen Palmer of SF Gate, who'll be moderating that one. I think Chris Bianco may be on that one too from Pizzeria Bianco. You're really not going to want to miss that panel. So whatever you do, go get your tickets for Pizza City Fest. It's going to be a doozy. If you like what you heard here today, dear listener, please go to wherever you listen to podcasts and leave us a rating, a review, subscribe. Seriously, all that stuff really helps, so we're really appreciative of it. We'll be back next week with another epic episode. But if you're looking for me in the meantime, you can find me on TikTok, Instagram, Threads, and YouTube at The LA Countdown. That's TheLaCountown. You can also find me on Instagram at LA Food Pod. That's LAFOODPOD.